Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts Live. I'm Andrea Kendall Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. Today, we're turning our attention back to coronavirus. We've had a few episodes looking at the pandemic in Europe, how Europe has responded, and implications for the transatlantic relationship. And today, we're going to continue with those discussions, but with a focus on Russia. And I think, you know, this pandemic came at a really precarious time for President Putin. It was just as he was advancing his plans to reset his term limits and stay on as president beyond 2024. The economy was already stagnant. You also have the oil production conflict that sent oil prices plunging. So I think that we have a ton of questions about the way that this pandemic will shape dynamics in Russia and how they'll play out for President Putin. And to help us think through some of those questions, we have an excellent guest with us today. We have Ambassador John Teft. For those of you who don't know Ambassador Teft, he served a distinguished career, 45 years as a Foreign Service officer. He was ambassador to Russia from 2014 to 2017, and he also served in Lithuania, Georgia, and Ukraine. So Ambassador Teft, welcome.
Thank you, Andrea. I'm glad to be with you.
I guess we should say, too, that he was also the godfather of all things Nordic in the early 90s at the State Department. So he is a father of many different initiatives from up there. And it's really great to see you even post Foreign Service career. It's always good to have you around.
Well, thanks, Jim. I was lucky enough for your listeners to have you as my partner over at the Pentagon in those days. And I think we did some pretty good work together.
We did.
We've heard rumors here about stories about these two eating whale blubber. So I think maybe we'll be able to get to those towards the end of the podcast. but maybe to start with, you know, just to hear Ambassador Teft, your thoughts on how coronavirus is playing out in Russia, how Putin has handled this. I think we've heard a lot about Putin kind of stepping back from the scene and kind of delegating power out to the regions in ways that he might be able to deflect blame as convenient. But maybe just to hear your thoughts a little bit on how you think Putin has been managing the crisis so far.
Well, I think in general, he, like a lot of other world leaders, underestimated what was going to happen. You'll remember back in the beginning of March, he was saying, you know, we got this under control and, you know, we'll manage this, and a lot of reassuring words. And it really wasn't until the end of March that he had a meeting with Mayor of Moscow, Sobyanin, who was also appointed the coronavirus coordinator. And I remember reading on the internet that day that Sobyanin had said to him, this is serious, it's going to get worse. And it was like an injection of realism into the Russian system. Sobyanin had told this to Putin with several other senior government people sitting around him in Putin's Kremlin office. And certainly that's turned out to be true. And as we've seen, the pandemic has taken hold and has spread. I think that from what I can tell, just checking again today, they've not come anywhere close to the peak. They had almost another 6,000 new cases yesterday. The number of people who have died has gone up, and a lot of this is without having real, reliable data on how many people have actually been infected, particularly outside of Moscow. So I think there's some big question marks there, but I think we still have to be patient and see how bad this gets. There's been articles in the press about how the hospitals in Moscow are already overflowing with people. How many healthcare professionals have actually become ill, apparently because they didn't have the adequate either instruction or equipment to be able to deal with these this virulent virus. So you've got a situation that seems to be, they're working very hard at it, from what I can tell, but it's still not under control at all. And this, of course, is raising lots of other questions about the economy, as well as about politics, which I'll be happy to talk about a little further if you'd like.
Yeah, I think for me, one of the biggest questions will be, and probably for all of us, is how this is going to affect Putin's plans to reset term limits. So we were already kind of midstream through this process of constitutional change. They had to delay the referendum to change the Constitution, which would have allowed Putin to stay on beyond 2024. How do you think this is going to affect those plans? I mean, with the economy the way that it is, probably, you know, the coronavirus is likely to even amplify the negative economic trends in Russia. Is this a time, you know, succession or these transitions are always a vulnerable moment for any authoritarian regime. So how do you think this is going to affect Putin's thinking? Do you think once things get better, he's going to press on? Do you think he's going to set this aside and try wait for a more opportune moment?
No, it's the $64,000 question, as we always used to say. And I'm not sure that I know or any of the experts who live outside. I'm not sure Putin knows at this point, to tell you the truth. Because I think, as you say, this is really the coronavirus and the impact that it's going to have on the economy and on social and political attitudes inside of Russia will have a big will have a bigger impact than anybody ever anticipated when Putin started back in January down this path to try to change the Constitution to give him at least the option of staying on for a longer period of time as governor. You know, Putin has always been a man who has treasured stability. And one of the great paradoxes today is that this coronavirus has done more to undermine the potential for stability in Russia than anything Putin could have done positive. I suspect that he's sitting and trying to figure out what the way ahead is. The things that he had planned, the April 23rd referendum on these constitutional amendments, that's shelved. The May 9th Victory Day celebrations have been postponed. I suspect that Putin is going to take stock as we go through this. Hopefully they'll get the pandemic under control in Russia, and he'll have to make his calculation. The tricky part is how much is this going to affect the economy? I think this is certainly going to be the biggest fiscal crisis of his time. Nabulina and the governments have managed, I think, the macroeconomic side of this, the fiscal side, pretty well over the last 6 years in the wake of sanctions and other problems in Russia. But this is going to be unlike anything that they've seen. At least the things that I've read, the oil price is not going up anytime soon. This morning, Nabulina cut the interest rate to 5.5% to help businesses. But the government has done very little compared to Western governments, either put money in the hands of ordinary Russians, you know, like our $1,200 disbursement, or helping small and medium-term business. I understand from a Russian friend that the medium-term businesses are going under rapidly there. And so far, they've only used part of the sovereign welfare fund. You know, this was created originally by Kudrin. If I think it's somewhere up at around its height, it was at 11 trillion rubles, which is, I think, $147 billion. This is not to be confused with all of their foreign currency reserves, which they still have. And I think the total of all of that is like $535 billion. But they've been very careful about not doling out any of this sovereign welfare fund. Maybe $2 trillion has been given to certain people in certain sectors, but they're holding on to more of it, presumably because they think this is going to get worse and they want to wait and see how it goes before they make the decision. And so I think the economic calculus is going to have to be made about, and then the political calculus on top of that. There's a lot of Russians, and I've been on a couple of webcasts over the last week or so where I've been listening very carefully to some of the Russian officials who I knew who are speaking about this. And they're quite concerned that ordinary people are just not going to be able to buy food. The social safety net is very bad in Russia, especially outside of Moscow. You've already had one demonstration in Vladikavkaz down in North Ossetia. Will you have more of them? If you look at the social media, people are already complaining that the medium and small businesses are not getting assistance. And that, you know, the allegation, especially from the opposition, is that Putin is saving the money to save his friends and his big business partners and Russia's biggest business oligarchs. But we'll just have to see, will the resentment rise? Will this transform itself? Will Putin then have to adjust how he goes ahead? I think he planned for the April 23rd referendum on the constitutional changes to be approved overwhelmingly. But now, will that actually have a, will they be able even to do that? So I think that, you know, I read this morning an article that my friend Anders Aslam, the great economist, is saying this could all bring greater democracy. Well, maybe. But Russia is also a very repressive place, and we've already seen them clamp down on people who are, you know, the doctor who stood up and complained about, who headed the Union of Medical Professionals, who complained that they were not getting enough equipment, and that's what was causing people to die. And they've also clamped down on journalists. Remember, the law was passed last year, the famous Russian fake news law, that gives the government almost any authority to go put anybody they want in jail who says anything against any government policy or action. Anyway, I'll stop at that. I don't have a clear sight on exactly what Putin will do, but I think he's probably factoring in or going to have to factor in a number of those things that I just kind of went through on the economic and political side, as well as the pandemic itself and its impact on Russian people before he can kind of calculate how to reset.
That's very comprehensive, John. Thank you very much. I have a question about the Russian society. If we went to Moscow today, would we see an approach very similar to what we've been doing in the West, you know, like social distancing, face masks, shutdown, that kind of thing? Or is it being handled differently? Is it business as usual there? And something that we would, you know, we've left long ago.
No, I think they've increasingly clamped down and shut things down, particularly in Moscow. I can't speak for outside of Moscow too much. I'll have a word on that in a sec. But I think in Moscow, you see people, I think, inside, because the government, the Moscow city government, has been very firm that they're not going to let people get out. I saw the other day that the police were stopping people who driving into the city from outside, because, of course, you know, Moscow is a city of, what, 12 to 13 billion, a million people, but another 3 million or so arrive in every day in cars or subways. They were also stopping people from getting on the subways and checking them. So I think there's an attempt to kind of clamp down on this. I was told that out in some of the rural areas, out in the provinces, out into Siberia, you have governors who adhere to the government, the central government's efforts to limit movement and to have a kind of shutdown of society. But in fact, a lot of things are going on because people simply have to live and they don't have the social safety net, as I said before. So I suspect that there's probably not as tight a control outside. But in Moscow, I think you'd see something similar to what we have certainly here in the Washington area and other major cities around the United States.
And I would imagine it's easier to enforce lockdowns to be more oppressive, if you will, when you're a totalitarian state. There's not the politics buffeting him. There's not the Putin. There's not the kinds of problems that. Certainly we've seen here with governors going in one direction, saying something, the president saying something else, the kind of chaos that we see, driven a lot by the president, of course. But I would imagine it's a little bit easier for Putin to say, we're going to be doing these five things, and those five things are done without a lot of pushback.
Yeah, I think that's generally right, Jim. I was on a web conversation the other day with a Russian whose judgment I trust a lot. And he described one of the factors that you see in Russia today as what he called a crisis of centralization. You have this central government, which under Putin's terms as president, has gotten more and more controlling of society, more and more controlling of the economy. And yet he's now delegating to the governors and mayors the responsibility to enforce social distancing and those kinds of things. But he's not giving them the authority to actually do a lot of things, nor are they giving them the resources to do it. So what this was described as a kind of a crisis of the centralized system, where you have on the one hand the desire of Putin and his friends in the Kremlin to control everything, but at the same time, they're not wanting to take responsibility, and they're delegating to the governors to do things. Now, some would say cynically that that's to be able to pass the blame when things go bad, maybe. But, you know, we have these tensions, as you pointed out, even in our own country, and you certainly see it in Europe and in other places. But I think it's exacerbated in Moscow because of this centralized system that Putin has built up over his 20 years in charge in Russia.
Very interesting.
I want to ask, just part of it will follow up on some of this repression question, but I think when things get tough in Russia, particularly when the economy is bad, so I kind of think of Putin has kind of three general pillars that can underpin his hold on power. One is the economy and some of the social contract. But then when that's bad, there's the foreign policy piece and people's kind of pride that Putin is returning Russia as a great power. And then there's also a repression piece. And so when things are bad at home on the kind of economic and social front, how do you see these two other pillars playing out? And maybe we can start first with the repression piece, and then I want to ask you about kind of the aid that he's sent to Italy and some other places. But first on the repression piece, I mean, one of the things that we're seeing is some attempts to use technology to control people. And so, you know, I've been thinking along the lines of, you know, this is going to accelerate some of the trends towards digital authoritarianism that we're seeing in other places like China. We're seeing the Russian regime trying to use apps to track people and all sorts of other kind of technical solutions to citizen control. As you think about this, how important do you think that might become for the Putin regime? And I guess I'll layer onto that. When you have appointments like Prime Minister Mishustin, who has kind of a background in technology and other things, do you think that this is going to give the Russian regime the opportunity to pivot or rely more on these digital tools to maintain control?
I generally agree with your analysis, Andrea. They started using technology, at least as I understand it, in terms of identifying people in demonstrations and stuff. Particularly last summer, remember when the big demonstrations went on week after week in Moscow, protesting the government's forbidding of opposition candidates to become candidates for election to the City Council of Moscow. And I'd read several pieces where they actually used this facial identification technology to be able to pick people out of the crowd, and then went back later and arrested him. It wasn't just the guys in the front row who were then pulled off by the police and sent to jail. And so some of that is there. There's been articles written that is going to expand, and as you said, to use apps to be able to pick people up. We have, as you know, in our own country, Google and Apple have developed this technology, which is voluntary. You have to sign into it, which is going to help states and others and individuals be able to track people who have coronavirus or had coronavirus, who they're close to. I think you'll see more of that in Russia, particularly if the situation deteriorates, the political situation, the social, and the more protests start. But I think you'll see the Russian police, as we saw in Vladikavkaz, be pretty brutal when it came to dealing with these demonstrators. I suspect you'll see that elsewhere. Russia has plenty of capacity in that regard, unfortunately, which they'll have to use. But I think the other part of this is, the impact on the Russian elites. What are they going to think if, in fact, the response of the government is to just simply crack down on people and not necessarily deal with some of the things like social safety net, if people start not having enough food? There are in Russia, according to my understanding, 11 million guest workers. Most of these are Central Asians, and they're in Moscow cities all over. Now, some are working in construction in Moscow, and that continues, as I understand it. But a lot of other ones are not employed anymore, and they have no even right to claim anything if the government were to do it. So what's going to happen to all of these people? They can't go home, because the borders are closed to the Central Asian nations. Is this a potential for or greater instability? There's a lot of question marks there, is what I guess what I'm trying to say. And I think, you know, the government will, especially if it's pressed, use any one or a number of these repressive technologies that may be developing, as we've seen in some of the other more authoritarian countries.
Yeah, the other question, too, is that to what extent the Russian public would tolerate those types of abuses, kind of having had a relatively open internet and other things. But I want to go ahead, please.
Yeah, I think that's right. I was told again by another Russian colleague that the shipment of equipment to Italy, especially, and also Serbia, did not go down well among ordinary Russians, because there were people who had the sense, this is now a month ago, that the situation was getting worse in Russia, and the on the streets, the question was, why the hell are we sending all this stuff when we may need it ourselves? And so, I have kind of a jaundiced view about that whole sending shipments of stuff. I'm not sure it had much impact in our own country, for example. We keep in touch with my wife's family out in Kansas, and you know, they didn't even see this stuff, let alone care about it. And most Americans are focused on taking care of themselves and their family, and you know, I don't think they saw much allure in this shipment of stuff that came to our country. And I have the impression that it kind of backfired even in Italy, with the La Stampa articles pointing out the Russian intelligence agents were shipped in as part of their assistance, and then the fact that a lot of the equipment apparently didn't even work. So a lot of people kind of got worked up, but in a way that was kind of an inside the beltway reaction, as opposed to outside the beltway or whatever the equivalent is in these other countries in Europe.
Yeah, I agree with that. That was one of the second piece that I wanted to ask you about this is, you know, what do you think Putin's mindset was surrounding that? Why do you think he was doing that? Is it that there were some lessons learned looking at what China was doing and the way that China was able to portray itself as an alternative to the United States and a responsible global actor? I mean, why do you think Putin went down that route, potentially understanding, or maybe he didn't if he's not getting good information from his advisors, but maybe understanding that it could backfire in that way if things were getting a lot worse in Russia?
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. I think either he didn't have the right information, or he didn't want to take it seriously early on in the crisis. And so his reaction was, hey, I'll do this. I'll try to take advantage of this problem that the Europeans, some of the Europeans and the Americans have, and I'll send this in, and we'll use this as good old Russian active measures to try to woo public opinion. But he didn't, I think, understand what was going on in our country, or in Italy, at least as I read the press there. And I don't think he understood what was going on in his own country. I'm speculating here, but I think there was a total, he didn't have his mind wrapped around the emerging reality there, that very quickly started to take things over. And I think in retrospect makes this look like a small little blip on the screen, not something that was really serious. I think, I said at the time when people asked me about it, you know, how big a deal do you think this is? And I said, I said then I didn't think it was going to develop into much. I thought much more serious was the continued use of social media, trying to undermine democracy, cyber attacks, and especially if they continue to do stuff during our campaign and coming election. That was going to be much more serious and have much deeper resonance and ramifications in our own society.
Maybe just one more question before we take it to the audience questions, and you're already moving in this direction in terms of kind of U.S.-Russia relations. If you put your diplomat hat on and thinking about whether or not this presents any kind of opportunity for U.S.-Russia cooperation, I mean, it is a pandemic. It's a shared experience. I mean, my own assessment is that we're not likely to see any substantive improvements in U.S.-Russia relations. But as a diplomat, if you were looking for openings, does this present anything in your mind? And I guess the backdrop to that, too, is that we've already seen Putin and Trump talk as something like 5 times in recent weeks. And I know that's been focused on the oil issue. But I know that Putin is leaning in and trying to capitalize on that, you know, to try to make it a broader opening in U.S.-Russia relations. But with your diplomatic hat, is this an opening? What should policy makers be thinking about?
I don't know whether we have work going on between our scientists on the coronavirus or other aspects of it. Most of the formal government-to-government scientific cooperation has gotten put on the back burner, or time has run out on different agreements, particularly after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I know there's some private things going on in cancer research, HIV/AIDS and things, but I don't know if anybody is actually doing private stuff on the coronavirus. There's maybe a potential there, and if I were the ambassador in Moscow today, I'd certainly try to promote that. But there's a lot of problems here. You saw yesterday Ambassador Sullivan spoke out against the repression against journalists in Russia and in Chechnya by the Kadyrov government. You saw he's spoken out quite forcefully about this incarceration and trial, in a secret trial that they're putting Paul Whelan, this American citizen, under. And then beyond that, of course, you have the bigger issues, which have really chilled and frozen the relationship, going back to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, as well as the interference in our elections. You know, I remember October, I think 7th or 8th. It was right after the statement, this 2016. Right after our Secretary of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, and then Director of National Intelligence, Jim Clapper, put out the first statement about Russian interference in the elections. Remember going into the Democratic National Committee records and the rest. And I remember seeing several Russians the following week, and I said, this is horrible. You know, you talk about trying to improve our diplomatic relations. This is going to undercut any potential for doing that, because it's going to destroy whatever there is in the political class in America, any hope of trying to do this. We'd already had sanctions after Ukraine had been effective two times, but, you know, they've just continued to do that. So even if we were to try to build some kind of reset or something right now, I think the political environment in our own country is such that, you know, if they continue these other things, that there's just no hope to try to be able to do that. So I'm kind of skeptical that we'll have anything in the short term here. If I were the ambassador, I just add one other thing here. If I were the administration, and I'm outside of government now, one of the things that I would do would be to try to extend the New START agreement. You can do this with a minimal amount of work, and it would be a positive step. It would also be more stabilizing. It would protect our security. But so far, the administration hasn't come to do that. They want to try to do a trilateral with the Chinese, and I don't think that got a chance at all. So, you know, there's some little things that you could do, whether it's cooperation in science and medical. New START would be the biggest thing, extending that and then going into a larger negotiation. But so far, we haven't had either of them.
All right, this is fantastic. I want to give all of our participants the opportunity to ask questions. We've got one question from Anna McAdoo. So if you want to just quickly introduce yourself before you ask your question.
Thanks.
Anna McAdoo, it's good to see you.
Great to see you guys as well. Actually, hopefully you can't see me right now, but in any event, Ambassador, we had a chance to meet when I was on the NSC in the previous administration, but you know, and thank you so much for joining us. This is great. I guess one thing I was wondering is, given the severity of the economic crisis, and it's, you know, it's pretty certain, it seems, that this is going to continue for a long time, especially for Russia with the softening of the oil, demand for oil, and the tanking prices, and the economic troubles of its most important trading partners. It seems like foreign investment is going to be one of the very few things that's going to help the economy to the extent that that's out there to be had. Do you think that will mean that there'll be a little bit more willingness on Putin's part to look for ways to take steps that could actually lead to sanctions removal, assuming we can get that organized on our end?
Hi, Anna. It's nice to hear from you again. I would say that's, again, another one of these questions that we don't know the answer to at this point. I've been talking to some of my friends about whether the possibility exists now for Putin to try to scale back the crisis in the Donbas. My colleagues, John Herbst, Steve Pfeiffer, and Bill Taylor did an article not long ago for The Hill, which said that the financial crisis in Moscow, the looming financial crisis, would put some pressure on Putin to do that. When I read that, I thought this is a good idea, but I really wondered whether President Putin would agree to do that. You know, he's one of these people who does not like to make concessions or be seen making concessions under any kind of pressure. It goes against his fundamental makeup. So I've tried to follow carefully what's going on in the Donbas, and I know there's supposed to be a meeting next week of the foreign ministers of the Normandy group. But I think until there's some change in Russian policy there, we're not going to see much of a break. President Zelensky of Ukraine has reached out and done some things, but he's also then been criticized sharply inside of Ukraine, and his own popularity has dropped, as we all know. So I think that gives him less flexibility to do much. One could argue that if Russia had actually seen this clearly, they would have found a way to move ahead, perhaps to engage Zelensky on something more. But that moment has now gone, and the coronavirus will only make it more difficult on both sides. Maybe I'll be wrong. That would be great if we could find some way to resolve the Donbas crisis and get the Russian troops and all of their surrogates and others out of Ukraine and find a solution to this. I think, though, on this, as so many others, I think Putin is sitting and waiting and calculating at this point as to what he really wants to try to do. And, you know, like most of us who follow Russia, I try to read the tea leaves every day, and I just haven't seen any changes. And the people whose judgments I trust haven't seen them either. And some of the Russians who I've talked to or listened to don't see them either. So I think we're going to have to just sit tight and see how this works.
Jim, over to you.
Great. Thank you. And this is a question on the Arctic that I was going to throw out as others are putting together their questions that they might want to ask. You know, we're looking deeply into this idea of Russia, China militarizing the Arctic and really trying to figure out, is this something that is truly aggressive, offensive, something we have to worry about, something that we are way behind in and we need to be taking steps in the U.S. and then within the alliance to deal with? Or is this something that is something that is happening, but it's not something that we need to look on as a great threat to the West or something above and beyond what any nation would do if a northern sea route suddenly opens up? So when someone talks to you about the Russian militarization of the Arctic, is that something you feel that we need to be ringing alarm bells about, or is that something that we need to be monitoring, understanding that we don't know necessarily where they're going, but right now they're not going in a direction that would cause us to start sending the U.S. Navy up into the Arctic?
My view is that this should be something we monitor carefully. I did this when I was ambassador in Moscow, and I'll have a word about that in a sec. But the people whose analysis that I see in the open press, I obviously don't have any access to the government assessments these days, is that, you know, clearly the Russians are building up their military up there, but this is more of a defensive as opposed to an offensive threat against us. I think the administration did well. The exercises that we do every year in Norway and the rest that you and I used to work on back in the 90s, Jim, those have continued, and I think they should continue. But I think, you know, at this point, a watching brief is going to be key. There's another factor here, which is how much money are the Russians going to have to do some of these buildups now? And this applies not just to the Arctic, but to obviously other things. Donbas doesn't cost them relative that much relatively, nor does Syria for that matter. But there's still going to be some pressure growing here as the Russian economy declines. I mean, the official estimate is, I think, now a 5% decline in GDP for this year. But people, economists whose judgment I trust, are saying 10%, and others are, I think Kudrin is at 7, or Greff is at 8, and there's others who are up as high as 15%. But you're not going to have a lot of extra money floating around to be able to do these kinds of things. So I think you should do I think we need to have a very careful watching brief, which I think we're doing. I would just say, just to tell a story, when I was in Moscow as an ambassador, I twice went to conferences in Arkhangelsk. And then once went to Murmansk. I tried to pay as much attention as we could possibly do in that time to what the Russians were trying to do. And of course, when I spoke, for example, at a conference in Arkhangelsk, I laid out the Obama administration, which I then represented, the position on the Arctic and how this we could work together on projects. But what was striking was at the Arkhangelsk conference that I attended, I was put in the front row because I was a senior American official present, and seated next to me was the Deputy Prime Minister of China, who had come to lay out Chinese interests in the Arctic and the need for cooperation.
Oh, that's amazing.
I have to say, nobody had told me in advance, but when I found out who he was and chit-chatted a little bit with him and then listened to his speech, it was really, this is back in, I don't know, 2015 or something, I started to see very clearly that the Chinese saw this as part of their economic spheres of influence, and they looked at it. And we followed it very, very carefully at the embassy and reported on it to Washington.
Oh, that's great.
Ambassador Teff, we have one more question here from an audience member. So I'm going to go ahead and unmute you, and if you can please introduce yourself before asking your question. Let's
see. Hi, Ambassador. This is Damian Murphy, a staff member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Thank you very much for doing this. I was wondering if you could comment maybe a bit more on how you see kind of the twin dynamics of coronavirus and the oil price drop in Russia as it relates to the political opposition and the positioning of Navalny and others and how they're kind of playing in this space right now. Thanks.
Well, thanks, Damian. That's a good question. I saw the other day that some in the formal opposition have started to put out social media pieces, basically trying to tie into those who are frustrated and angry about the way the Russian government has handled the crisis. This came, I think, immediately after the government, I don't know if they arrested, but put down the doctor who was speaking on behalf of her colleagues and was upset that the government had not provided the equipment, the protective equipment that they needed. I think the opposition will probably try to do more of this, but I think they'll bide their time until they see how society develops over the next couple of weeks. They, of course, have to be extremely careful because they can use the anything on the social media, using the social media law or the fake news law, whatever, to try to repress them. You know, and we saw last summer many of the key leaders during and then in the months afterwards of the demonstrations in Moscow over the city council election candidacies, they got arrested or pulled in. I can't remember how many times Navalny got pulled in, and others did as well. And I suspect you will see the government, as we were saying before, use whatever techniques it has to keep the lid on and to be able to put down any attempts to try to protest or show greater opposition. You know, early on in the crisis, in addition to the sending the equipment to Italy and Serbia and the United States, there was a certain triumphalism among the Kremlin circles. Dmitry Trenin of Carnegie, Russia, wrote about it, that there was kind of cockiness that, you know, now we're seeing the West, meaning the U.S. and Europe, struggling with this coronavirus, and, you know, we're so much better than that. Well, that faded pretty fast, obviously, as the pandemic took hold inside of Russia, and you don't see that kind of stuff anymore. But, you know, that may be one of the, you know, be a double-edged sword, I guess. On the one hand, this kind of arrogant triumphalism that our system is better may subside as the Russian system tries to cope with the pandemic. But at the same time, it'll also make the government more sensitive to any kind of criticism at home and prompt them to take steps to stop that or to stifle it as quickly and as firmly as they can.
Great. And I have one more question from one of our participants on the Open Skies Treaty. And the question is kind of, you know, this administration seems to want to withdraw from the Open Skies Treaty. And the question is what you think that would mean for Russia-European relations. Would Putin be able to take advantage of the situation if that treaty is no more?
I'm not an expert on the Open Skies Treaty. I think we should keep it going. I don't agree with the administration on this one. And it's possible that they could take advantage of it. But there's a lot of other things that they might try to exploit in the U.S. Or in the with the relationship with Europe. Even though I spent most of my career in Eastern Europe, I'm a firm Atlanticist, and I believe strongly in strong alliances and the value of NATO and the value of our relationships. You know, I'm not naive. I understand all of the problems with trade and the rest of it, but I think we have for many years managed those differences and the problems while keeping intact the fundamentals of NATO and the Western Security Alliance. And I think that's really the key. As I said before, I think one of the things that I would do now if I were running things is to try to get New START renewed, not just because it gives us this very good possibility to check on Russian compliance, but it also is a kind of the last remaining pillar of stability in this U.S.-Russian relationship. One of the things I pushed hard for when I was ambassador in Moscow was the strategic stability talks, and we finally got them going in September of 2017. Tom Shannon, our undersecretary, met with Deputy Foreign Minister Ryabkov in Helsinki, and there's been some since then, and I think that's all to the good. Not that it's solved any problems, but you got to keep talking. I was always a proponent of doing military-to-military conversations, and I give General Dunford great credit for what he did with Gerasimov. The channel on Syria, non-confliction was important. The continuing the incidents at sea discussions was important. I think you can disagree, you can maintain sanctions, but you can also keep these channels of communication open, and I've always been a proponent of that. Doing it with our eyes wide open.
So it's that time of our podcast where Jim likes to ask the really deep and profound questions. So Jim, over to you for our last question.
Well, thank you very much. This is we'll see how deep and profound it truly is. But first, it's so great to hear from you again, John. You are the classic diplomat that I learned so much from. I know Sandy Virschbaugh was also on the a participant in this, and you and Sandy and a lot of colleagues there from the State Department, what you just said about the alliance and about communications is so important, and it's that statecraft that I hope we can keep alive through this administration and into the next, which is so important. And I just wanted to say how great it was to hear just the last 5 minutes of what you said. Just reminded me of what wisdom there is at the State Department. And I'm sure it's still there. It might be a bit hidden away right now, but you're a great example of that, as well as Sandy. And so, you know, as we look at your career and as you think about all the things that you did, not just in Moscow, but so many years of tilling the vineyard, if you will, of U.S. diplomacy, and you've now left the Foreign Service, you're in private life. And so what was your takeaway from that career? As you look back on those years and all the stories we were telling before we went on the air, what did you come away with as you look back on those days?
Well, I'm proud of the things that I was able to do. I think I did my best trying to represent my country. I was especially at the end of my career when I was ambassador, fortunate to be asked to be ambassador in four different countries. My wife, Mariella, who was my true partner in all of this, and I tried to do our best representing the U.S. in Lithuania, Georgia, Ukraine, and Moscow, what was then the second time, because I'd been there as the DCM. And, you know, I think that we tried very hard to build American relations with these countries, but we tried to work with our European friends to build a post-Cold War European security system. Now, we all know the problems and things that have developed in that, and I'm not going to go into all of that. But I still think that was a noble goal, and it's something that should still be our goal. Now, some younger people may think, well, it's another one of those old Cold War fuddy-duddy guys. But I think George H.W. Bush had it right. We wanted to build a Europe whole, free, and at peace. And I understand, again, all of the realities that are out there today. But I still think that that's a goal that should be what the American government, whatever government is in power, should try to achieve to help Europe. Because, you know, I'm old enough to remember the problems that we had. I came into the Foreign Service, and we were still dealing with the Soviet Union at some of its worst points. The memories, my first trips to Europe, I used to go see concentration camps, and I was in Eastern Europe and saw the horrible communist regimes there. You know, I'm old enough to remember all of that stuff, and I don't want to see that stuff come back. Yeah. And I think we should continue to try to push in that direction. I'm proud of the Foreign Service, and one of the things that breaks my heart is to see how the Foreign Service has been treated over the last few years. This kind of came to me again the other day in relation to the coronavirus when the stories appeared. I think it was Josh Rogan in the Washington Post told the story about the science counselor at our embassy in Beijing going out to Wuhan a year or so before the crisis and going with the consul general to visit this laboratory where they were doing research on the viruses that were in bats. Now, there's speculation that it wasn't in the market, but that it was a leak from this lab that caused this virus to get loose. But I suspect nobody paid that much attention to the report back then. But our guys, our Foreign Service officers, were on top of it. And they sent in two cables, according to the Washington Post piece. This is the kind of thing that the Foreign Service can do, not just represent our country, but we can pick up stuff and we can investigate things to help advance America's national interest. The other thing I believe, people once asked me, you know, are you an idealist or a realist? And I said, I'm a Midwestern pragmatic idealist. You can see my cheese head hanging on the wall over my shoulder. And I still am like that. I still believe you have to have the goals and the ideals, and I articulated those when it comes to the transatlantic community. I still believe we need to have a better relationship with Russia. We need to be firm and push back on their aggression. But at the same time, we need to leave the channels of communication open so that we can take advantage of them when we're able. And, you know, that's kind of the way I come at all of this. I've spent 6 years of my life living in Russia and a lot more working on it from the Washington end. I think I understand how the people in Georgia and Ukraine and Lithuania, just as some examples, see Moscow. And, you know, I hope I'll live long enough to see the situation in Russia change so they get away from this kind of post-imperial syndrome of trying to reconstitute the Soviet Union and their control, if not of the countries, if not sphere of influence, and to get back to building a Europe whole, free, and peace. I think it can still be done. We've still got to have that as our overriding foreign policy goal for this part of the world.
Excellent.
Really excellent. Ambassador Teff, thank you so much for joining us. It's all of the insights, but also some of these lessons are so valuable. And we just thank you for taking the time to join us and sharing that with Brussels Sprouts listeners and with folks on the line today. So thank you again. And we hope we get to do it again.
It's great
to see you. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. Great to see you.